Representative, I noticed that your district in Waynesboro is right next to a tobacco hut and a gun shop. Was that on purpose? And when you found that location, did you hear angels singing hallelujah and did the skies open up to reveal the heavens above?
Well, the gun shop, yes, because I go there all the time. So Harold's Gun Shop is one of my favorite places. Mr. Harold, he's one of those classic gun shop owner guys, right? Like you go in there and he has historical artifacts, right? Like, you know, firearms that I wouldn't even want to touch, let alone fire, right? Because I mean, they are just so pristine. The tobacco hut was sort of accidental. That was there. I enjoy getting my cigars from Boswell's up in Chambersburg, not the tobacco hut. But it's interesting how that actually I got the district office. So it was the same location my predecessor, Paul Schemmel, had, and essentially he left on a Friday, left the keys on the conference table, and on Monday I came in and got them, and it was just a seamless transfer. And for those that know Paul Schemmel, Paul is brilliant, right? Mm-hmm. I have half of his IQ points. He is one of the smartest people I've ever met. But with that, he operates on a different plane from the rest of us here. I remember after I had won the primary, and, you know, we had breakfast and we were talking about transitions because, you know, I didn't have a general election. It was looking, you know, pretty solid that I was going to be the next rep. We're having breakfast and Paul sits there and he asks, says, so would you like to keep the furniture? And I'm like, oh, sure, Paul, that's number 473 on my list of things to do. But, you know, yeah, I'll take the furniture and, you know, keep the office and all that sort of stuff. It really wasn't until I'm sitting there with other freshmen in freshman orientation when I realized like how critical that really was, right? Because they're trying to figure out where they're going to put their office. They're working with card tables and folding chairs. I mean, it is it was bizarre. You know, with some of the stuff that they were having to work through. And I honestly, I mean, for me, it was just a seamless transition. So I'll put up with the tobacco hut. Sometimes we get some interesting aromas that permeate over.
A lot of strawberry ice and things like that.
But, you know, it's really the smell of gunpowder from over at Harold's that I really like. You know, it smells like victory, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, it's a great location. I love my office. It's literally a 10-minute walk from my house. Not that I walk it all that often as much as I should, but, you know, it's a great central location. Tractor Supply is across the way, so, you know, it's just a good spot, and I'm just very fortunate to have it.
You've entered the smoke-filled room, where we cut through the haze of Harrisburg politics and get to examine the laws and lawmakers that really drive the discussion.
Well, Representative Chad Record, thank you so much for joining us today. So you represent the 90th Legislative District, which is essentially the southern portion of Franklin County. Tell me a little bit about your district and your constituents. Who are they? What are their issues?
We're God's people, right? This is for me, this is home. You know, we're celebrating 250 years in America. My family came over, the Reichards came over from Germany in 1763, and we found the promised land in Franklin County. Our family farm that we settled in is about 8 miles as a crow flies from where I live, right? So this is home. Franklin County is home for me. It's where I grew up. I went to Waynesboro High. You know, we played football against Greencastle and James Buchanan. Successfully against James Buchanan, not so successfully at the time against Greencastle. You know, obviously things change over the years, but you know, it's there is no greater honor in the world than being able to represent your hometown, your friends, your family, your neighbors, people that you grew up with, and being their voice in Harrisburg. We're farmers, you know. We're artisans, right? We're, you know, machinists. We have a lot of manufacturing. We have, you know, Grove Manitowoc. We have a whole bunch of industry there. You know, we are professional people. I mean, there's lawyers, but there's also just this, it's Mayberry, right? It is home. It is everybody, you know each other. You know where people come from. You know, you're not afraid to leave your doors unlocked at night because I have a neighbor and I love her to death. And she knows everything that goes on in that neighborhood. And, you know, I might be out mowing grass and she'll stop over and talk. And, you know, you haven't, you know, my Sometimes it takes you, you know, a couple hours to mow grass, not because it's a big yard, but because, you know, you see your neighbors and you have those conversations. I have a mentor who's a township supervisor. If I get a knock on the door at 8:30 at night, it's because he was just driving through the neighborhood and thought, like, you know, stop by and have a conversation and a beverage. And I love that feel. I love our district. I love the 90th district. I love the people in Franklin County. They're the backbone of this country. They are the people who make America what it is. And truly, you know, again, as we're celebrating our 250th year, I think America begins and ends in Franklin County.
Tell me what your childhood was like growing up there. What did your parents do?
So like I said, my family has been farming for 9 generations. When I was a kid, Dad started off as a dairy farmer, not that far from where I grew up, in Washington Township. Mom was a nurse, city girl, city meeting. She was from the town of Waynesboro, right? She wasn't from the farmland, the outlying area, but she didn't have that farm experience. So, Mom and Dad, as you do in marriage, you find compromises, and Mom decided that, farm life wasn't for her. So they moved, we moved off the farm. Dad took a job as an ag teacher up in Shippensburg School District. My grandfather had been the ag teacher at Waynesboro for 40 years, there are a lot of folks. I mean, I'm very fortunate to that my grandfather was who my grandfather was. Gerald Reichard was very well respected in the community. A lot of students who had him, just even today, I'll go out and I'll say who are you related to? I'm like, well, Gerald Reichard's my. I had your grandfather in school, and he was one of the best teachers I ever had. So I'm very fortunate to have that. And talk about your upbringing. Spending summers and stuff with my grandparents. The family's work. My parents worked and that sort of stuff. Pappy always. We always had a project, redoing the back deck, and you learn to read a tape measure, things like as an adult you kind of take for granted, but it was just it was just a very good upbringing. My parents were always very supportive of me. Things I wanted to do, they would support. Things I didn't want, I found out very quickly that baseball is not my sport. I love watching it, right, but I can't. Playing it is a different aptitude and skill set that I do not possess. We found other things. I joined a rifle team. I did competitive shooting. So there were different opportunities, and just had a very, very supportive family. I know a lot of folks don't have that opportunity, but I was very, very fortunate, and still we're a close family, and had a lot of good friends. I still have a group of friends from high school. We get together and we play. Poker, low stakes poker. Every couple months, and it's a diverse group of people. I mean, we've got, people, business owners. Landscapers or engineers. I mean, it's just a group of people that you graduate from high school with, and you kind of keep those bonds. And I remember when I went off to college. People were talking about, their high school experience, and people were talking about it like they went to the United Nations, right? I mean, they used all these different, diversity and ethnicities and all that sort of stuff. We didn't have that in Waynesboro, but we did have was economic diversity. Where I went to elementary school, the school's catchment area was from a very, very, very nice neighborhood, but it was also from, an area where a lot of families, the only reason that they had food was because their freezer was full of venison or squirrel, whatever the case may be. So you had two very different economic realities, and I think that's kind of helped shape me too. That we're all the same. We all put our pants on the same way. At the end of the day, we're all. It's all about supporting our family and whatever shape that might be.
How has your district changed since your childhood?
It's grown. There's new developments, and we were one of the growing areas of Pennsylvania, at least the eastern portion. So I-81 kind of is that dividing line. Tuscarora School District has seen a population decline, but we have a lot of folks that are moving up. A lot of new businesses. I mean, we have a Walmart now, right? Like it's things like that.
Made
that
a big time.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, so it has grown significantly over the years. New folks moving to the area. We have, you know, some retirees and a lot of military. We used to, when I was a kid, we had Fort Ritchie, which was an Army base that was BRAC, that was closed down in the late 90s. And, you know, a lot of folks who had served at Fort Ritchie but had gone, you know, with their military career elsewhere, actually come back and they settle in the Waynesburg, Greencastle, and Mercersburg area just because, you know, they love, you know, the rolling farmlands and the sense of community and everything. So we've grown in population, and of course, you know, you have some of the challenges that go along with that. But by and large, the general spirit of the people remains.
Gotcha. So I'll ask you the same question I ask other members who have very similar districts where it's those very small town community that is very quickly growing. How do you, and you have a background in local government, how do you think you balance economic growth and growing your community while maintaining that sense of a small community?
Well, a big part of it, and I know our county has been very active, is farmland preservation. And we have a lot of preserved farmland in the 90th District and Franklin County. And it helps preserve that rural flavor that, you know, that you know, people like to move to the area. It's funny. I remember when I used to worked at the township, you know, people would, you know, retire here from, you know, Maryland and Virginia, you know, Baltimore, northern, you know, D.C. area. And we'd get the phone calls that, my God, there's this horrible smell. I was like, well, that's, you know, Mr. So-and-so, the, you know, farmer down the road who's spreading his manure.
Yeah.
You know, the smell goes away. And like, oh, it's horrible. I said, well, you moved out here for the fresh country air. This is what it smells like sometimes, right? So, you know, there's that balance that you have to strike. You know, so preserving our farmland and our green spaces. You know, we have a lot of forests. We have, you know, Michaux Forest right next to us. You know, a lot of hunting, and again, that's part of our culture. But you know, there's areas of the township and in the district where you can look at new growth, and it makes sense where other growth has already occurred, and you know, you keep it in certain areas, but you preserve open spaces elsewhere, and there's a way to balance it. There is absolutely a way to balance it, but it's just a matter of trying to find that balance, and you're never going to please anybody. There's always the we used to joke at the township. It was last house syndrome. You know, a person comes into the area and they build a house, and then they believe that their house is the last one that should ever have been built. You know, and you know, I remember one of the folks at the township saying, "Well, you know, we had a person that was saying you had last house syndrome," and they said, "Well, you know, I used to hunt rabbits where, you know, your house was built." So, I mean, things change over the years.
Yeah.
And but managing that growth and managing it smartly, and I think we're doing that. I think the municipalities are doing that very well in the 90th. So we're fortunate. It's not like it is becoming overbearing at this point.
I think it was one of the first shoots I did when I first started working here. I believe it was Representative Dan Mao. We went out to a farm and it freshly manured, and he takes a deep breath and goes, "You smell that?" And we're like, "Yeah, definitely." He goes, "Smells like money."
And that would be Dan. Dan is one of my favorite people up here. He is, I call him Pops because he's like another dad, right? And he is just a genuinely good human being who cares about his constituents. His district is right next to mine, so you know, that depends on the way the wind's blowing. It could have been you know, the money in my area or the money in his area that you were smelling. But yeah, Dan, you know, our districts are very similar, and you know, both geographically, but just in the way that it's changing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I remember coming home from college, and you know, you put down the window, and you get that smell. And to me, I love that smell because it's home. It, you know, it just reminds me about all the good things of where I grew up. So,
well, you just mentioned coming home from college. Tell me about your college experience then.
So I graduated Waynesboro, and I went off to American University down in D.C. And I was convinced that there is no way that I am returning to Waynesboro after I graduate. I had a, you know, good experience down in D.C. I, you know, had some good internships. I did a semester abroad in Germany, which was very, very interesting. I took 3 years of German in high school and was still unprepared for how little I actually spoke the language. But to me, it was one of those things that I was very proud of myself. I'd never been out of the country before. I was 4,000 miles away from, anyone that I could call, family, or that sort of stuff. And, was able to kind of live on my own and figure out and operate in a foreign country where I had limited language interaction and, be able to navigate the train systems and all that sort of stuff to get to, where I was living and figure it out. It was a great experience. And it was interesting because, the program that they had, there were a lot of international students. So it wasn't just, Americans that were over there. We had, Russians, and we had, there was French and, people from Singapore. And it was just this international. One of my buddies was Scottish. And, the Churchill quote or something like we're a common people separate, or we're one people separated by a common language. It was interesting how a person, who spoke English, or so you thought, you're so, very different in some of your words that you would use. But I really enjoyed it. It was one of, I remember it was a bunch of us Americans that were over there. It was about six or so of us, all guys, and we decided we were there over Thanksgiving, and we wanted to have a traditional American Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. By that time, we were homesick, and we invited some of our, our other friends, from around the, to experience that with us, and I didn't realize how hard it would be to find a turkey in
really?
Germany, and so we ended up getting a duck. Now, none of us, right? I mean, again, you're talking about a bunch of guys.
Two completely different birds to cook.
Well, exactly. And, again, you've got a bunch of guys that are in, their late teens and early 20s, and you got this duck that you got to figure out how to cook. And, after a lot of Googling, we figured it out. And, I think if you were to, feed us that meal now, you'd probably kind of turn your nose. But for us, it was one of the best meals. It was the most memorable Thanksgiving I think I've ever had because, there we were 4,000 miles away from home, but we were able to, have our, keep our traditions. And this was something that we prepared. And we had, mashed potatoes, and we had all the fixings that we, again, a bunch of guys tried to make. But it was certainly something very special.
So as a cold-blooded American, and I'm sure you might share some of these sentiments, I try not to take too much from the Europeans aside from the Magna Carta, and especially Germany, never taking humanitarian advice from them.
I know, right?
And I say that as someone whose family also came from Germany back in the 1700s, like yours did. Yeah. But was there anything that you learned in your time while in Germany that you think affects you in the way that you legislate today?
Yeah, actually, it reminded me of how good people are, how just generally humanity across the world, there are good people everywhere. I talk about, how I was able to navigate the train system. The only reason I was able to do it whenever I first got there, I got off the plane in Frankfurt and, very little sleep. It was one of the red eye flights. And, it's a language that I barely knew, and trying to find my, the plane was delayed getting there, and getting through customs was horrendous. So I missed the train that I thought I was going to take. So like, what do you do now? And I'm standing on the train platform, and this girl walks over to me, and she's about my age at the time. She was in, her late teens, early 20s, and she says something to me in German. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't right now. If you speak English, this is great. And she did. And she said, would you mind watching my bags? I'm want to use the restroom. So I said, sure, fine, whatever. And, she comes back. We start talking. And she was going close to where I was going. So she helped me navigate. So it was just a random chance, whether, it was divine intervention or just the general goodness of humanity. She helped me sort of navigate, and we were joined by another guy who was actually going to the same university. He was from Spain, so the three of us kind of linked up together, and we kind of worked our way through it. And it just, if it weren't for the goodness of her, I'd probably still be standing on a train platform in Frankfurt. So, that was one thing that I really resonated with me, was just no matter where you go, there's always people that are willing to step out of the way and help you.
So there's no public transportation in Franklin County that prepared you for that?
No, no, we don't have any, you know, trains or buses or anything along those lines. If you didn't have a bicycle or, you know, a ride someplace else. So yeah, it was just a unique experience, but you're right. You don't take a whole lot of from the Germans socially.
Yeah. So you have a very interesting path to becoming a legislator, or even just getting into government work in general. Yeah. Because I understand that after graduating from college, you became a bartender.
Yes.
Tell me about the journey from being a bartender, graduating college, to eventually going to work for a Pennsylvania senator.
So I was going off to college never to return to Waynesboro again. And when I graduated in 2012, and we were still in the middle of the recession, and the unemployment rate for college grads was like 50% or something. Mm. So I returned home. I was an insurance agent by day, and I was a bartender on nights and weekends. And at the same time, I moved in with my grandfather. He had beginning of Alzheimer's. It was a deal I struck with my mom. She's an only child, so Pop-Up didn't have to go to a nursing home. I didn't have to pay rent, right? I was, you know, sort of a caretaker. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd get him dressed in the mornings and, you know, get him dinner and all that sort of stuff. And it was that experience I wouldn't change for anything in the world. It was me and the World War II vet. You know, Pop-Up was, you know, he served in the Army Air Force during World War II. He flew on bombers. And but he was just always one of the most calm, patient, happy-go-lucky. Because, I mean, you know, no matter what happened in life, I mean, nothing fazed him after going through that. And even, you know, as his memory started to get worse, he was always in such a good mood. I remember, you know, I first moved in, you know, being the young guy that I was. I went, you know, got a case of beer and stuck it in the refrigerator and, you know, came home from work the next day and we went to the refrigerator and saw that the beer was gone. And my grandfather, drank a beer, forgot he drank it, felt like having a beer. And he went through a case of beer in an 8-hour day. I go on the back porch and he's just, you know, laying out in the chair, just sound asleep, just as comfortable as could be. And I send a picture to mom. I said, guess what your dad did today? And she's like, how could you let him? Just like, mom, he's 87 and he served our country, right? He's not driving. He's not wandering. And so after that, I ended up hiding the beer in the vegetable crisper because, again, a guy in his 20s isn't using the vegetable crisper. And, you know, I'd put three cans out every day as his beer ration. But I lived with him for 4 years, and I wouldn't trade that time for anything in the world. But I was working as an insurance agent, and then I was a bartender on the nights and weekends. And it was one of the guys I took care of at the bar recommended me for a job with our state senator at the time. And, great. Sounds like fun. And, it was just a very unique opportunity that, it was funny. My chief of staff was also a bartender. And, the joke was that our office made the best cocktails. is that sort of interpersonal skills that you learn as a bartender or as a waiter, or, you know, things like that. This morning we just had a group of high school students from Greencastle were up for a government career day. And one of the things that was resonating is, you know, those first jobs, when you learn those soft skills of how to interact with people, those are the ones that really set you up. It doesn't matter what internship or anything you have like that. It's those first jobs that kind of teach you the basics of how to, you know, interact in the workforce. But, I worked 5 years for our senator and ended up working about 18 months for our congressman, and then had been in local government as a planning and zoning officer for 5 years before getting elected. So, you know, it was that interesting experience as a staffer, you know, at all three levels of government that, you know, it's kind of given me a unique perspective on how government interacts with government, and more importantly, how government interacts with people, or in some cases it doesn't, or does it poorly. In ways that we can find efficiencies and try to make things better, because at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, making sure. I mean, we're, as taxpayers, we're funding this behemoth, right? So it only makes sense for it to be as efficient and responsive to people as possible. And I think that's one of the biggest frustrations I've had, you know, especially in this role now, but you know, throughout the careers, when you see just flagrant abuses of government and you know, just that lack of empathy sometimes. It just really it grates against me. And you know, I always, you know, when I was planning and zoning officer, I always treated permits, you know, for building permits and that sort of stuff, like the same way that we treat concealed carry permits here in Pennsylvania. It's a shall issue. You meet all the requirements, here you go. Good luck, God bless. You know, and just, you know, get government out of the way and let it be as and let people do what people do.
Why did you run for office?
It was interesting. I've always had the interest in doing it, but you know, as a staffer, you know, like, you know, the more you see, like, maybe not. But it was after Paul had announced his retirement, I had a fair number of folks reach out to me and ask if I was interested. Mm-hmm. And I figured, well, that's at least a couple votes there, so that's helpful. And it was a unique opportunity to be able to represent your hometown and be their voice in Harrisburg. And it was because of that I ran, and I, by the grace of God, was ultimately successful. But it was just a really it was humbling. It's humbling when you have people, you know, reach out and ask, it's like, hey, you know, we think you'd be good for this. And it just, you know, again, whether that was, you know, divine intervention or whatever, I tend to believe it was. Religious guy personally, and you know, I think that sometimes, you know, the Lord puts a path in front of you, and you don't know why, you don't know what leads you to where you're going, but you know, you kind of follow it along, and it's for His purpose, whatever it might be.
So after working with so many elected officials, was there a moment, maybe it was when you were filling out your ballot, the first, or when you ran, and seeing your name being the one that was on the ballot, what was going through your head at that point?
It was weird. It was surreal, right? Like, I mean, you know, I've been voting since I was 18, and you know, it's you get involved with campaigns. You know, you know sometimes you know some of the folks that are on there, but when it's your name, it's different. And even now, when it's your name on the door, right? You know, and you're the one that's making those decisions and, you know, representing your folks. It is, it's humbling. And I keep using that word, but it truly is. You know, and you think, well, I mean, what you're there to serve the people. And that means whether you're, you know, at the grocery store, you know, and picking up dinner for the night, or if you're, you know, if you're out to eat, or if you're at, you know, the movies, or, you know, even at church or something like that. I mean, it's not a 9-to-5, and you know, you're always, it's always part of your DNA to be that person and working on problems and helping people out. And I enjoy that, but it was absolutely surreal when you're looking at your name on the ballot and darkening that oval next to it.
As someone who's worked in every level of government, which do you think is the most and the least dysfunctional?
Surprisingly, the least dysfunctional is local government. I mean, you know, the number of times I was a township supervisor before I became a staffer, you know, the number of times that someone could come in during public comment and you know, have an issue that you're able to adjudicate on the spot, you know, and get it resolved. I mean, that was almost unheard of. Obviously, the most dysfunctional is D.C. I mean, the federal government. It is so large. It is so cumbersome. You know, and we are such a large and diverse nation that, you know, it makes it very, very difficult for that to work. But you know, local government, there's a special place in my heart for local government and the people that serve in that, because, I mean, again, the pay, you know, for your township supervisors or borough councilmen are negligible, right? But you know, they're good community-minded folks that show up and try to make their place, their hometown, a little bit better for the next person that comes around. But yeah, I was always very impressed that, you know, either as a staffer in local government or as a supervisor, a township supervisor, you know, you could try to work and find some common sense solutions, and you could usually make it work out for the folks.
So, having being a staffer and, again, serving at all levels, was there anything that surprised you when you were elected to be in state government?
A little bit, actually. You know, there's that transition. Again, when your name is on the door, it's a different perspective. Yeah. You know, when you're the person who's casting the votes, I mean, there's that weight that you feel. I mean, when you're a staffer, you feel that too. But you're advising, right? You're putting together policy briefs or talking points or whatever your role is. But when you're the person that's doing that, and people look to you, and it is a very different perspective, and I enjoy it. It is again truly an honor.
So I'm assuming you were pretty jaded from the start in terms of the
the salty old staffer, yeah. Right? I mean, you know, when it's interesting, you get people that come in and you know they're going to change government on day one, and you watch them, and they don't always they find out very quickly how difficult it is, and you know it's a slow process, and it's a slow process by design. I think our founding fathers, you know, wanted that stability and want you know the highs and lows of public opinion swaying government. It's to be a stable institution and working within that. So yeah, jaded is a word that you know sometimes you're not going to change it, but sometimes change comes slowly, and it's something that you have to work at over years. I mean, I look at Dan Mao again, who's been here for 20 years, and there's things that you know he has been working on for 20 years, mm-hmm. and that's what it takes.
Yep. I usually tell people if you hear a candidate who's running for the first time saying, when I get to whether it be Harrisburg or D.C., wherever it is, I'm going to do this and that. I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to get rid of that.
Yeah.
Either they're so naive that they have no business
yeah.
running for this position or they're lying to you.
Yeah.
But you seem to be one of the exceptions where you have actually been able, as a freshman member, to get things done for your constituents and get government out of the way. Very recently, there was an issue with a golf course
yes.
in your district that you were able to provide some movement on an issue that has been an issue for a long time for constituents. Tell me about that.
So, and it wasn't anything I did alone. I mean, that one, there's, and that's, I think, sort of the beauty of our system is that it's getting other people involved. Dan Mao, again, mm-hmm. huge, huge, huge advocate and supporter. I mean, he was tenacious with this. Mm-hmm. He used to represent the South Mountain area. So the backstory, obviously, is that DCNR was looking to not renew a lease with the George family, who has been operating South Mountain Golf Course since the 60s. You know, a beautiful golf course down in the area. It's a little 9-hole golf course. It's well maintained. It's a staple of the community. You know, our local fire departments have their fundraisers there. I mean, it is a bedrock of our community. You know, seniors go. It's a very walkable course. Seniors go up there and play. It's got wide open fairways, so whenever I tee off and the ball goes out 200 yards straight and then turns 90 degrees to the right and goes off and God knows where, you know, I can at least have a better chance of finding it.
So I got
to
play some golf there.
Truly, it's a outstanding course. So Dan was, you know, there was just helping me lead the way. He was in the meetings, helped set it up with the appropriation staff, mm-hmm. Chairman Struzzi. And, you know, in the staff and the Appropriations Committee, setting up meetings with Secretary Dunn, Rob Kaufman, who represents just north of that, I mean, just with his sage advice and wisdom. You know, Brian Cutler, you know, I took him to go play golf over there. You know, he had mm-hmm. the former, you know, leader and speaker. I mean, he understands the bureaucracy better, and he had, you know, just good advice. Torin Ecker, Judge Ecker now, you know. And just the list goes on. Jesse Topper, as far as I'm concerned, and Jason Gottesman are the men that really, I mean, mm-hmm. got involved with the governor's office and Jesse with his ability, Leader Topper, I should say, with his ability to go in and negotiate. It really took an entire team to do that. And, you know,
Before we get too far into that, what was this lease? Why did this golf course need a lease from DCNR?
So DCNR owns the land, and the golf course sits on DCNR land. And for whatever reason, DCNR said that they were going to be building a visitor center in the Michaux. On that was the only place that they could build this visitor center mm-hmm. out of 100-some-odd thousand acres
yeah.
that you know DCNR had in the Michaux. This was the only place, and it didn't add up. I mean, it's so far off the beaten path. We had you know, some local news folks, some TV stations up there, and they were going through, and like they had trouble finding the golf course to do the story. I mean, if you're looking for a visitor center, I mean, you don't put it in a place that's hard for people to find. Yeah. And that's kind of counterintuitive.
So what do you think the reason was?
I think that there was some issues, some local issues with some local folks in DCNR and some the family that had owned it. And I think that it just had it moved its way up the chain to the point that it was untenable, and they had to, you know, keep covering for it. And fortunately, you know, the cooler heads prevailed, and with, again, with the assistance of pretty much, you know, every rep in the area and in the in our state senator and some folks over in the Senate, we were able to convince the governor to direct DCNR to renew that lease. And it was an early win, but my God, when I got that phone call from Leader Topper, I mean, I think that my neighbors probably heard me yell. I mean, it was just a really special thing, because that was such a well-loved institution. That golf course is huge for our area, and you know, no one outside of our area knows about it, right? But it's a key part of our community. It's been there for forever. It was actually established back in the 30s, and the George family's had it since the 60s. So it has just been, you know, a key part of our community. And, it doesn't need to make sense to the people in Harrisburg, because it makes sense to us back home, and that's what we're here to fight for. So that was huge. And, again, I couldn't have done it on my own, you know, and I absolutely – you know, share credit with every person that had a role in saving that golf course. And I'm looking forward to, you know, sometime this spring, and I've talked with the family about having a opening day. I mean, they're already open now, but an opening day ceremony to just in inviting everybody to show them, you know, that it wasn't just one person fighting for it. It was a team of people who were invested in this. From the leader on down to, you know, lowly freshmen like me, you know, it's just people that were committed to good government doing good things.
Even when it doesn't involve government overreach, you've been a very big advocate in your community. Recently, Penn State has closed their Mont Alto location, which is in your district. And tell me about some of the work that you've been doing to help fill that gap.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, disappointed with Penn State's decision. I mean, the Mont Alto campus started off as the State Forest Academy. It was founded in 1903 with the idea that it was to train Pennsylvania's foresters, because the governor at the time, I think it was Governor Pinchot, was big into forestry as, you know, as a science and managing our state forests. And Penn State acquired it in 1937. And had been operating it obviously ever since. And the forestry component is absolutely critical. It's the origin story of Mont Alto, of Penn State Mont Alto, and the Forest Academy there. And fortunately, there's been some discussions with DCNR about them, with a successor organization having a very large role in forestry programs at Mont Alto, and maybe some of their internal trainings, bringing that in there as well. We've also been talking with WellSpan, you know, our local health care network. We have a desperate shortage of nurses in our area, in our system. And Penn State Mont Alto graduated 14 nurses last year that were all taken in by WellSpan. They graduated more nurses than 14, but 14 of them went to WellSpan. That's critical in our area, and WellSpan is planning to step up and continue that part of the education as well. Our school districts, and we have 900 applicants for 450 spots at our county career tech.
Wow.
So it's more than double what we have available. And so they're looking to expand technical education programs out there. So this successor is really going to be doing a lot of things that are going to be benefiting our area. I mean, we have a huge demand for skilled labor positions. We have a large interest in skilled labor positions. Mm-hmm. So that will get, you know, it'll be bridge that gap between those who are interested in the jobs that we have. I toured Manitowoc a couple of weeks ago, and they told me that they could hire 200 skilled labor positions tomorrow and still not have a full complement.
What is that?
So Manitowoc is we locally would call it Grove. They are the last U.S.-based crane manufacturer.
Okay.
And they've been, you know, in Shady Grove in the 90th District operating for well over 100 years making world-renowned cranes. And they need welders. They need assemblers. You know, they need electricians, people to be able to operate the, you know, those skilled labor spots. Again, they said they could hire 200 tomorrow. The full opening they have is 500. But, you know, just to get to a place where they would be, you know, at least keeping their head above water, it's 200 people tomorrow. So we have the need in the area. So we need nurses. You know, we need healthcare professionals. We need these skilled labor positions. These are all high-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, people can graduate. Joe, buddies I graduated high school with that went to tech, you know, to VoTech and graduated as welders. I mean, they were making 60 grand a year out of high school. You know, I was the idiot that I was, went to college and I was paying 60 grand, you know, to do that. So, you know, it puts these people further ahead. It fills the needs that we have in our district. As far as our workforce is concerned. And again, that partnership with DCNR to be able to keep the traditional forestry program at Mont Alto is going to be absolutely critical. I mean, again, I think they need the forestry folks as well. I mean, you know, they've expressed an interest in it. So I think what will come from the unfortunate decision by Penn State to close Mont Alto will be an institution that meets the educational and training needs for Franklin County and our region. You know, it's not just, you know, selfishly for Franklin County, but you know, for the larger you know, South Central region.
So more details to come on that.
We've been having the conversations with the folks from Penn State about this, and we're working out the details. So until the details get worked out, that's the 30,000 foot view.
Gotcha.
The treetop view.
So, I like that. Yeah. You mentioned Mount Alto and forestry being a big part of Mont Alto's development. Mm-hmm. I know that Mont Alto is home to the famous squonk. Have you ever come in contact with one before?
No, but I've been searching for it ever since you'd mentioned the squonk, you know, the mythical creature that's there. No, I haven't encountered that. You know, we have a couple. There's always been claims of Bigfoot in the area too. So so there's, you know, all sorts of things in the Michaux that, you know, you're just not quite sure what's out there. You know, I remember when I was a kid, the Record Herald, our local newspaper, there was a photographer, Sid Miller, who every April Fools would, and it was before Photoshop existed. He'd always have a joke picture in the front page, you know, above the fold. And I remember one year, He had someone in a gorilla costume pretending to be Bigfoot, and you know, Bigfoot sighting in the Michaux. So we have all sorts of mythical creatures. You know, it's while you're golfing at South Mountain, you know, you might take a side quest and go and take a look for some of these out there. So
tell me a little bit about the bills that you have introduced here. The first one, House Bill 1998, to modernize and improve medical treatment in workers' compensation.
Yeah, so that one in particular it's designed to kind of thread that needle, right? Where you know, when you have folks that are unfortunately injured in the workforce, you know, they need a team of doctors, you know, and healthcare professionals to get them healed and back in the workforce and as quickly as possible, so that, you know, there's no downtime in their paycheck for them to earn, that, you know, the employer has the ability to know that their person is getting the health care that they need, so that they are back to 100% when they're ready to enter back into the workforce. But what that bill does, so right now there's a cap on the amount of time that you a patient can spend inside the network that a employer has, you know, with the specialists for that particular type of job, you know, to get the person healed back into the workforce. Essentially what this bill does is that it removes that cap so that, the injured worker can continue with that group of healthcare providers, again, who know the industry, who know the injuries that they are facing, and can work together as a team to get that person healthy and back into the workforce again, because that's what this is about. It's about making sure that people heal from their injuries and are able to go back to work, because again, it's so critical. And what this bill does is, by doing that, it ultimately cuts back on workers' comp insurance premiums. Pennsylvania has one of the highest in the region. It's interesting, when we had a hearing on this bill a couple months ago, the PA Chamber said a lot of businesses look at that and they decide to not locate to Pennsylvania because of that weird rule where you're only able to be with that panel for a certain amount of time. So it just increases their workers' comp premium. So it attracts businesses to the area and it provides more consistent health care for injured workers.
So it's better for the injured workers. It's better for the business.
It's a win-win.
Who's it bad for?
it's bad for personal injury lawyers.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, you know, they're the ones that, you know, like to go out and drag out these claims and unfortunately sometimes slow the healing of injured workers for the sake of lawsuits. So again, it's not all you know, personal injury lawyers, yeah. But you know, there's always some bad actors out there. And again, this ensures that the worker is able to stay with the group of medical professionals who are best suited to get that individual back and healed into the workforce.
Energy obviously is a big issue in Pennsylvania. Yeah. Right now, your district is facing a very unique problem in terms of energy, where they're looking to put power lines in, not to better their energy grid, but Maryland's.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So the Transource lines, they were first proposed about 10 years ago in 2016. And essentially what this is doing, Transource and PJM are claiming this is a quote-unquote market efficiency measure to reduce the costs for electricity in Maryland and Northern Virginia. And 10 years ago, the conversation was about, you know, for the residents down there. Now it's about the data centers. And the reason for this is because, you know, those states with those blue states have made the conscious decision to stop all generation. You know, they think that that clean natural gas or whatever, you know, or nuclear or any of those, you know, sort of generations, coal or whatever it might be, are bad. They're evil. And so we've got to stop that. But their people still need electricity. And they've made the decision, especially in Northern Virginia, that we're going to allow these data centers to come full bore. Well, you're not generating electricity, but you're sure using a whole lot of it. You know, your people are in these data centers. So, you know, but Pennsylvania, because of the decisions that we've had here, especially since we were able to eliminate REGI last year, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, we are a major energy producer and also an exporter. But instead of using that electricity here in Pennsylvania first to benefit Pennsylvanians who, you know, are you know, bearing the burden of the, you know, the generation and everything with that, what PJM wants to do is they want to take that electricity that we're generating here in Pennsylvania and ship it down to Maryland and Northern Virginia, because, you know, again, those states down there made that conscious decision to not generate electricity. So what they're going to be doing is they're building these power lines. And it's not just in my district, in Rob Kaufman's district. You know, there are several proposed throughout Pennsylvania. And the thing that really irks me about Transource in Franklin County is that we have some of the best non-irrigated soils in the United States. The best farmland. I mean, our yields, our crop yields are through the roof. I mean, again, our soil is so, we are so richly blessed with the quality of agriculture that we have. But these power lines are proposing to take that farmland, you know, and there's going to be, I think it's 130-foot, you know, buffer and right away through these power lines, that there can't be any construction or anything along those lines. They're taking this economic driver for us in Franklin County, our agricultural heritage. They're taking that so that data centers in Northern Virginia can get power. That's unconscionable to me. That just absolutely irritates me to no end. The fact that, you know, we in Franklin County are paying the price for what blue states down in Maryland and Northern Virginia have decided that when they are not putting any generation down there, when they decided that they are not going to produce any electricity down there, but they decide that they're going to open the floodgates and let these data centers come in while the folks up in Pennsylvania can deal with that. Well, I represent those folks in Pennsylvania, and I am sick to death of those D.C. and those city elites coming thinking that we're just, you know, flyover country, right? That there's nobody that's there. Well, we have people that live there. And if you want to eat, if you want, you know, to have farms, this is where it is. And so you are going through and you are taking away, again, our farmland for your benefit because of your stupid policy decisions. And that's what this Transource power line represents to me. And that's why I'm so opposed to it.
So while you're all fired up,
yes.
How do you feel about data centers?
I'm not a fan of data centers either, right? I get the fact that we use, you know, our phones and our technology are, you know, what they are. But my God, I mean, these things, the way they consume electricity, the way they consume water. And Josh Shapiro, the governor, wants to put a fast track in for this. I mean, I was a municipal planning guy before all this, right? You know, there is a value to having planning done, as Pennsylvania does, on the local level, where locals can have a say in where these things are located, where they're sited, you know, what the impacts are going to be on their local communities. I mean, if these data centers can find a way to handle their own electricity, whether they bring their own generation, you know, we talked about small-scale nukes or whatever the case may be, these data centers, they need to provide their own generation. They need to pay for their own electricity. You and I, you know, as ratepayers, shouldn't be subsidizing these billion-dollar companies. And they need to solve the water issue. If you solve those two things, and there's a place for that in a community, then come on down. But you got to go through the process. You got to start with the locals. You know, you've gotta get the buy-in on the local level. When the governor wants to put a fast pass in and just allow the, you know, to have statewide jurisdiction on citing these things, that is absolutely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. It has to start on the local level. This, you know, again, it's no different if it's done in Harrisburg or if it's done in Baltimore or Richmond. You know, when you're having these big city elites that are just placing these things wherever they want, and they forget that there's actual people that live in these areas. Again, that's why we need to preserve the local planning side of this, and that's why we need to ensure that we have the electricity to meet these needs. You know, again, in certain areas it makes sense if they want them, if they need the job and economic development. Homer City is a perfect example where they took an old natural gas power plant and they turned that on to power the data center. That makes sense. That's fine. You can do that. But don't tell me, and it was the same thing we just had last week, and I'm still fired up about this, where we had the data center bill, and people were like, well, if you don't like data centers, you should be voting for this. But the thing of it is that there were requirements in there that 25% of the electricity had to come from renewable resources, which is solar panels. We already saw that pressure in Franklin County. Again, where you have solar companies that are getting tax subsidies from the state and federal government so that they can offer higher rent, land rent, than our local farmers can pay, right? They're pricing local farmers out of the market, you know, for land that otherwise would be used for productive agriculture, you know, because they're offering, you know, farmers, you know, four, five, six times whatever the market price is for land, and putting these solar panels in there, and they're taking that ag land out of production. I did the calculations for a Homer City-sized data center to be placed in Franklin County. If it was to be powered solely by solar, it would require 10% of Franklin County's land area in order to provide enough electricity just to power that data center. Regardless of how you feel about, you know, solar and renewable, if you want to put the panels on your roof, knock yourself out. But the technology isn't there. It's not ready for, you know, any sort of large-scale development. And that's what we're seeing here again is these data centers, we have to be able to plan for them. We have to plan for them smartly. And I don't think having a statewide jurisdiction doing that is the way to do it. Again, these data centers need to pay their own way. We should not be subsidizing them one penny.
Recently, House leadership came out with a package of bills to help make Pennsylvania more affordable. You have one of the more fun bills with that. And a lot of these bills are tax holidays, whether that be a gas tax holiday, lowering the personal income tax. Yeah. But yours, I think, is one of my favorites, and that is to do a sales tax holiday on guns and ammunition.
Yes.
How did you get to be a part of that? What does that mean to you?
For me, again, it goes back to when I was talking about earlier about, you know, friends I had growing up that the only reason that they were, you know, able to have consistent meals at home was because, you know, mom and dad went out and filled the freezer with venison, right? You know, so it also, and I'm going to borrow from Representative Borowitz a little bit on this. The Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear arms, but yet we're still replacing a sales and use tax on. She has the legislation to remove that permanently. My legislation is only to have a 6-month holiday. You know, to again, as we're going into spring gobblers coming up here. You know, deer season this fall. I mean, you know, to remove the tax on hunting rifles and you know, ammunition. I mean, just makes it all the more economically feasible for people to go out and be able to fill their freezer and have alternative sources of food. And you don't have to go to the grocery store. That you know where that deer came from. You know, but it just makes sense. And I was talking, actually, it was funny. I was over the weekend. I was talking with a buddy of mine. I was telling him about this, and we're both Second Amendment guys. And he said, "Chad, if you do that, you know, you and I are getting, you know, 5.56 by the pallet." Like, yeah, we are. Like, yeah, the UPS guys. Like, yeah. I thought this was a gun shop. No, it's just the sales. It's just sales tax holiday. We're stocking up, yeah. Right? I mean, but that's the thing. I mean, you know, to tax a right like that, to tax our Second Amendment right, you know, is questionable to begin with. But, you know, at least providing at least a 6-month holiday here is, you know, we're having the broader conversations about affordability, you know, allowing people to be able to spend their own money. I mean, it's not for government to tell people what to spend their money on and what to do and how to do that. We're not the people's bankers. You know, giving people those opportunities to go out and spend it on themselves. I mean, I have the conversation every year about you know, tax refunds. You know, your buddies are like, "Oh man, I'm getting a big refund this year." Mm-hmm. So, well, you just let the government be your banker,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's better for you to have that money and you be able to decide how you're going to spend it at the time, rather than send it all to the government, then you get a big check back. And that's what we're looking to do with these sales and use tax holidays, is that, you know, these different aspects of our lives, whether it's childcare or newborn needs or, you know, guns and ammo or you know, fireworks, or, you know, there's a whole list of things that, you know, again, we're just trying to get government out of the way of what the free market does best, and that's create economic activity and opportunity and allow people to be able to use more of their hard-earned money to buy the things that they need and buy the things that they want. I mean, that's what grows our economy. I mean, you know, I'm a Friedmanite from way back. It's, you know, it's allowing people to be able to spend their own money and that's what our Republican values are. And as we continue to have these conversations around affordability, it's absolutely about reducing people's tax burdens and allowing them to be able to buy more and spend more as they see fit.
I recently bought a 10mm pistol.
Attaboy, you didn't shoot like a polar bear or something?
I mean, it's for when I go backpacking. I like to backpack down to West Virginia.
Yeah.
So I joke that I'm like, if I ever carry this and somebody tried to rob me, it would be cheaper for me to give them my wallet.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly.
So as somebody who has a gun that uses very expensive ammunition,
yes,
I would greatly appreciate if that bill is passed.
It's to say, I've got a 45 Long Colt and I was out at the range and I was like, $1, yep. $2, you know. So yeah,
it's not even fun. It's just
that's right.
Sad.
That's right. I was out with a buddy. So all right, are you ready to turn dollar bills into brass?
Yeah,
about what it is. So,
well, Representative Chad Reichert, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was a great time.